All right, good morning to everyone. We will be starting class just momentarily, about a minute or so, discussing the topic of whether or not idolatry works based on Talmudic discussion between the rabbis and the Romans about 2,000 years ago. It's on page 54b in Tractate Idolatry, Avodah Zarah. And we'll just start in just one moment. So we do post these classes online pretty much right after the class is concluded. So if you've missed any part of it, you'll be able to hear the class in its entirety just by going to the audio page. That's the eighth link down on our list of links on the website. This is interactive. If there are any questions at any point, we'll pause and invite your comments or questions periodically throughout the session. And if you're joining online, you can type it in on screen, and we'll try to address those questions in a timely fashion. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, Doug. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, thanks.
Good. Hey, Ken. How are you?
It's late.
All right. Did you have a chance to take a look at that Talmud?
Yes, we did.
Pretty interesting, huh?
It is.
I was just looking over it this morning again. I saw one more thing. It's amazing how many times you can go back to it and see another twist.
We've also got Raheli and Svetlana and Sean on the phone.
Okay, hello to everybody.
Hi.
Hi. And maybe someone else who just joined.
Okay.
Yeah, Brad and Mary.
Oh, good morning.
Hey, Brad. Hey, Mary. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay, doing well. Doing well. This New York summer has not been as ferocious as the past couple of years, so I'm really enjoying the fact that it's you can walk outside without having to take a shower after five steps. Hey, it's one of the good things about the drier regions. Well, I guess you really appreciate it more if you live in New York, but it's sort of like, putting itching powder on you all the time, and then one day you don't put it on, so I don't know which is better. I would say San Diego is better.
San Diego is hard to fight.
I hear they have pretty much like 70 degrees year-round, right?
I think it is pretty close to that.
You know, it's very unfair. They have that weather, plus they have the beautiful scenery. They got a double blessing over there. But they get the earthquakes down there too, don't they?
That they do get the chance of, yep.
Okay, I feel better now. Okay, so let's take a look. Okay, so let's start with the Mishnah. And we'll just take it step by step. There's just a few points that I want to focus on, but I think that's really what the crux is of this this whole area. From 54B to 55A at the bottom. So let's just read the Mishnah. And I'll wait for you to comment on it, all right? So the Mishnah reads that they asked the Romans about 2,000 years ago. So the Romans asked the elders, the Jewish elders in Rome, they said as follows, if it's God's will that idolatry is not something that he desires, so why doesn't he just destroy the idols? So the rabbi said back to them, they said, you're right. If it were the idol itself was something that the world did not need, so he would destroy it. But since everybody worships the sun and the moon and the stars and the constellations, God should just destroy his world because of the fools? So the Romans said back to the rabbis, okay, we hear you. If that's the case, let God destroy things which the world doesn't need. For example, like, you know, stone idols. All right? So the stone idols are not necessary for, you know, crops and for, you know, the sunlight is not something which emanates from stone idols, and there's no need for the world. So why doesn't God destroy idols that the world doesn't need and leave the ones like the sun and the moon and the stars and the constellations that the world does need? I mean, do some sort of like a compromise. So the rabbi said back to them, he says that if God would do that, so it would be strengthening the hands, meaning strengthening the opinion of the sun worshippers, because they would say, look, the stone gods are destroyed because they're really nothing, but the sun and the moon still around. That means that they must be real deities. Okay, that's the end. Facts are clear, right? Should I repeat it?
Seems clear.
Okay, so what's the argument?
I'm not sure what you mean by the question.
Well, I mean, the Romans have an opinion. They first start out by saying a certain view. So we have to understand, what is their view? Right? They're saying that if God's will is not that idolatry should exist, you know, God desires that idolatry is not there, and that's something which applies to Ben Noach, you know, Ben Israel. And so if God does not desire it, why isn't it just destroy it? So each part of the conversation we have to understand. So what is their opinion, and what's the rabbi's response? They say, well, the world needs these things, so God's not going to destroy it because some fools. So then the Romans come back and they say, well, then, why didn't we have a compromise? Let God destroy things that... They said they agree, basically. You're right. We need the sun, we need the moon. So they changed their opinion. But now we have to understand what their second view is, because now they said, let God save... You know, he'll spare the sun and moon, but destroy all the stone idols. So it sounds like a fair compromise. So then the rabbis say back to them, well, if we do that, so then it's going to... it's going to reinforce the belief of the sun worshippers, because they'll say that the idols were destroyed because they're nothing, but the sun and moon were not destroyed because there is something to them. They are real deities. So at each point in the conversation, we have to understand what the theory is behind each speaker.
the beginning in the first statement, wouldn't the Romans be coming from the standpoint that says, look, you guys are claiming there's this God and that all these other things we worship aren't true, but if there was, why doesn't he just, you know, make this all very clear to us by destroying all the things that we do?
Well, not so much to make it clear, but to, if he has his own will, so let him act on his free will, let him act on his will that idolatry should not exist.
Right.
So they're saying that, I mean, those are the facts. Right, so what are you saying again?
Well, I'm still not clear. The facts seem clear.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say, what's their argument?
What is their theory? Because they have a certain view, and that view is what's causing them to say this should now be the result of our view of God's justice. But the rabbis say, no, that's, you're right, God doesn't desire idolatry, but he shouldn't destroy the world because of some fools. So there's basically an underlying view of each speaker. I mean, that's the hard part here. So it is going to be, you know, it's not an easy thing. We're used to just, you know, hearing a person speak, and what he says is all there is to his words, but this is not so. I think even King Solomon said it, that, you know, the words of a person are like a very deep well. That you can get a lot from it. I'll give you an example. This past week, one of the news services from Israel, Arutz Sheva, had reported on the Pope and how they reenacted some sort of an edict that they should have in their prayers, I think they call it the Latin Mass, they pray for the Jews to have the veil removed from their eyes and they should accept Jesus. Basically, that's the gist of it. So some Jewish groups, I think Abe Foxman of the ADL was at the forefront. They were very upset. And how can you do this? Which you have to realize is no, you know, this is not a change in the church's view. But they quoted in the article one person who says, now, how are we going to sit down with interfaith dialogue if they just want to convert us? So, the first word, meaning now, how are we going to sit down with interfaith dialogue, shows you something. It shows you that this is a surprise. Meaning now, there's a change of events. Meaning up to this point, interfaith dialogue made sense. But now the person's saying, now that they said this, now how are we going to have interfaith dialogue? Because now they said that they're praying for the Jews' conversion. But this has always been the case. So it shows you how there was, the word now indicates that there was a surprise that these Jews had. And it just happened to be that the same position that the church had all the time that the Jews never wanted to admit, now just was just a little bit more, you know, pointed. And this is nothing new. But you see that when a person says now you can think into, why is the person saying the word now? Oh, because they must be surprised. Why are they surprised? So that word now unlocks, it unveils a bit more than just what they're saying. So we could read into that and understand something about the personality that's saying those words. Now, the Romans also. Here, similar, it's the same two groups. It's the Jews and the Romans again. So it seems to be it's going on for 2,000 years. And the Romans here are saying, so if God doesn't desire idolatry, why doesn't he just destroy it? Evidently, that's a wrong view. But they had a position. What is the position that would dictate that as being a proper response? So there must be an underlying view.
Rabbi, is it possible that the underlying view is that they saw their concept of God was just like a big king? A dictator that they were used to in their society, but just sort of a big version of that, and that whenever he didn't want something, he would just declare that it be abolished. And they had no concept of the larger picture of what Hashem is trying to do in the world, of the idea of free will or mitzvahs or anything like that, but just, here's this guy sitting up on a throne, and he doesn't like idolatry, so okay, decree that it's all gone.
Exactly. Right, so you got it. Meaning their view is that it's a very simplistic approach. It's the worship per se, which is what is deplorable. Right? Whereas, like you just said, that is not what God wants, and that's what the rabbi said. The rabbi says God is going to destroy the world and ruin it for everybody because of some fools. No, he's going to leave it. He's going to leave these things. People will succumb to idolatry, but that is okay. That doesn't go against the bigger picture. You're right. God does not desire idolatry, but what he desires more is that you do not follow it based on your own internal decision. So it would be better if they didn't have, but I mean, anything, the truth is, anything that God creates can be used as an idol. So, but evidently creation was necessary, and this is now what the greater good is that your free will determines whether you worship it, not God just destroying the idol. If God would zap a person with a lightning bolt every time he deviated, you'd have no free will, and that's not what God wants. He wants you to arrive at decisions intelligently. So that's exactly the point, Doug, right?
And so it appears that their focus is on the idols, whereas Torah's focus is on the idolatry.
Right, exactly. Their focus is on the objects, the action per se, where the rabbi's focus is on the individual perfection, meaning what's the perfection that you get here? It's not just that your hands are tied and you can't bow down. Let your hands be untied, but use your free will to determine. I mean, it's a life of intelligence, not a life of just restricted activity. It's not the actions. It's not the external world or the physical that is the important, and that's what the Romans were saying. The rabbis were saying it's the internal world that has to be changed. That's really what God wants. But evidently, when they said that, so the Romans did not get the answer. They didn't get the picture clear. Because what did they say back? They responded, okay, well, they focused in on the necessity aspect, the practicality of the sun and the moon. So they said, you're right, we practically need the sun and the moon. So let God destroy the idols that are not really contributing to the good of the world. And let God keep the sun and the moon. You see what their response is now?
Yes.
So they didn't move. They still have not, they didn't really get the point. So now, they respond, the rabbis respond back, and they say that by destroying the stone idols, they would reinforce false views. There's a separate consideration over here why that can't be done. But you see, the rabbis did say at the outset that if the world didn't need it, he would destroy it. They did say that. Which means that God is not going to put anything in the world which is purely for causing man to deviate. But the sun and the moon, these things are necessary, so you can't get rid of them. So there is nothing in creation. That's what this rabbi is saying. If the world didn't need it, so God would get rid of it, meaning he never would have made it. God's not going to make something which is purely to cause people to err. Everything he created is for his glory, which doesn't mean in the egotistical sense, since God is not human, so there's no such concept as ego. But when we say that he makes it all for his glory, he makes everything in order that... So what creation is really a laboratory that God created, and then once he set up the whole world stage, then he created man as the last creation on Friday of the 6 days of creation. Now he brings man to the picture to use this laboratory to study God and to come to realizations of truths. So everything he created was put there for another, it's another stepping stone to get closer to God, to get greater knowledge of God. So that's what they're saying. If it was something which did not contribute to this at all, you're right, God would destroy it, meaning he never would have created it. But it's not the case. So we see that the Romans had a hard time moving from their view But then we'll go into the Talmud, and we'll see how this unfolds more, and how there were a couple of other cases where they actually spoke about apparent proofs that idolatry worked. Okay, so let's just pause here and see if there's any questions, any comments.
Yeah, Rabbi, it's Rahili and Svetlana. We just are confused about something.
Yes.
We feel like the rabbis, by reacting, like, if Hashem, you know, really despised idolatry, then he wouldn't destroy those things, but people need them to survive, like the sun. It's kind of like eliciting the reaction that they ended up getting from the Romans, because they're not really saying straight up just the fact that people will make their own choices about what they're going to worship. Am I being clear? Maybe, like, what I'm trying to say is that if the rabbis are giving a reaction, if the rabbis, why didn't the rabbi just initially say people have free will, and it's, you know, so it's not necessary to take something away or to abolish something, whatever, people have free will and it'll choose to worship idolatry or not, and it's in the people's hands, so whether God takes away things or adds things, whatever, it's not going to affect anything.
You mean, why did they... You're asking why did the rabbis respond as they did? They should have just said that God wants you to have free will.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like that is what they're saying. They're saying that these things are necessary, is one consideration, so God's not going to remove that from the world. And additionally, the fools that make a mistake, so God's not going to destroy the world because of fools. Meaning, when they say the word fools, they're introducing the fact that certain people are misguided, and they aren't using their free will properly. And that is something which is part of God's will, that people should choose one way or the other. So that seems to be alluding to the free will aspect. But because people use their free will and make mistakes, God can't step in and now tie their hands. So they are taught, they are bringing in free will. It's just not as clear and open, I think, as you were suggesting that they should say it.
Yeah, we feel like they're almost inviting this kind of reaction on the side of the Romans, because they're focusing on the fact that should man not have needed the sun and the moon, then God might have decided to destroy them.
Well, they did say that. I mean, to say, in other words, that God would not create anything that is going to just be purely misleading. But the sun and the moon are not. You need it. And first of all, keep in mind also, who started the conversation here? It was the Romans. It wasn't the rabbis. There was no type of misleading going on. They were minding their own business. But, you know, the people are always attacking Judaism because they have the sense of reality that it offers, and that, you know, they have a problem with it. So they're the ones that are taking the pot shots. So they're saying, listen, it's purely just an activity. It doesn't want that activity being done, so get rid of it. So there's a couple of answers. There's a couple of reasons here.
Right.
All right, so one reason is you can't just destroy things. That's a foolish concept. So they're directly addressing a couple of issues that they have. One thing is that the world needs these things. So what type of suggestions, you Romans, are you saying? That God should get rid of the sun and moon? Don't you know that you can't live without light and without the energy that the sun provides to make plant life grow? You're going to die. What type of response is this? So they're showing them it's completely foolish. And then the other aspect is the free will aspect. Because of a few people that showed them, because of fools, they take something which is necessary and they project their wishes onto it. Therefore, God has to destroy his whole plan. So they are bringing in free will, but they're focusing on the primary errors.
Okay.
But again, you know, the Mishnah, which this is something that you have to study. So they're going to give you information, but you have to, they're leading you on to that you have to unravel, like when we started out the class, what is the theories underlying here? This is not just a conversation. This is something which is a Mishnah. So therefore, there has to be a lot more here. This is Torah Shabbat Peh.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else? Any questions? Any comments? Okay, now if you look in the Gemara, we're not going to read the Gemara verbatim here, but you see as it goes on that the Gemara continues and starts again. Slight different variation on the very conversation. Seems to be a second conversation, which is almost duplicate. But if you're sensitive to the words, the Mishnah just says that they asked the elders in Rome, if God does not desire idolatry, why doesn't he destroy it? If you look at the Gemara, where the Gemara starts, it says the philosophers asked the elders. It doesn't say there were philosophers in the Mishnah. And they said, if you're God, right, in the Mishnah, it just says, if he. Now they gave the right title. God means a governor, right? Then they also formulated the question, because of what reason doesn't he destroy it? So the question in the Talmud has three additions, which seem to show that the people are more articulate. First, it calls them philosophers. Then it refers to God as Elokeichem. And then it says, Mifnei Ma, because of what reason? They were seeking out an idea. So you see that the Gemara seems to be citing, it seems to be a different conversation. All right, Rashi says these were the wise men of the nations, right? So these were not the Romans. Maybe even in the Mishnah wasn't the Romans, but the conversation took place in Rome. Okay. Then it goes on and shows a couple of questions, and it says, they said, for example, I'll give you another case. They say, if a person steals a certain amount of wheat, and he plants it, so by rights, it really shouldn't grow. Right? By rights, it really should not grow. Because the person stole something, so in terms of absolute justice, God should not reward a crook with a seed that now he can grow his own field and now make his life off of stolen goods. Right? But he says that what has to happen is the world has to go according to natural law, and those fools that are corrupt will eventually have to come to judgment to God. All right? Another case, if a person takes his friend's wife and has intercourse with her, all right? So really, by justice, she shouldn't give birth because this is incorrect. But really, the world has to go by natural law. God saw all this. He saw the ability of free will. He created it. But what will happen is that the person will pay the price. So, again, the same answer. God is not going to stop your mechanical activity. That is not what God desires. What he desires is that you use intelligence to live your life, and you have the ability to sin or to do good. Okay? All right. But eventually you will pay the price, meaning justice will be enacted. Okay. Now, and it gives a case also where there was a town and the people were serving idolatry, so there was a fire that was sent to the town that burnt down everything except for the church. So they wanted to know, what is this? It seems to be that the church is protected. So the Gemara gives an analogy. And it says, if the son of a king got a dog, and he called the dog by the name of his father. So who is the king going to be angry at? Is he going to be angry at the dog that was named after him? Or will he be angry at the son? So of course he'll be angry at the son. Meaning so he says the same thing here. The worshippers are the ones that God punishes. He's not punishing something which is inanimate, which is not to blame. I mean, the stone structure of the church is not the place where God takes his anger. He's trying to show the people. All right, so that's just another statement. What I want to get to now is that now there are two primary cases in the Talmud, which is on now 55a. Okay, and we're going to compare them, and then we're also going to ask what the necessity is for both of them, and you'll see why. Okay, so far so good. We're all on the same page. Everybody following?
Yes.
Okay. If there's any time you have a question, just, you know, if you're online, type it on the screen. If you're on the phone, just, you know, interrupt. Let me know that you have a question. Okay. Now, we're going to start from 55A, where Agrippus was an officer, and he asked Rabbi Gamliel a question. And he says, we'll skip that one. I want to do the Zunin. Okay, Zunin, here we go. It's about a third of the way down. So Zunin, who was a Jew, he asked Rabbi Akiva. He says, both my heart and your heart know that idolatry, there's nothing to it. But he says, once I saw a guy that was crippled, he was hunchbacked, and he went to his place of worship, and later when he came out, he was completely upright. So he had a question. All right. So what was the answer that Rabbi Akiva gave him? He said that, I'll give you an analogy. He said there was a man and his wife. They had an inn in a certain town. And anytime people would, you know, come to town from afar, so they wouldn't carry around all their wealth with them. They were sort of like, you know, a bank. They'd put the money with them. They'd deposit with them. They would do it with the witnesses. And then they'd go travel around the countryside, whatever. And when they were about to go back home, they would come back to the inn, collect all the goods, and they would go home. One time, somebody came and he didn't use any witnesses. So, and he left all his money there, and then he went to go do his business. So the wife says to the innkeeper, says, listen, he left all his money, let's take it and that's it. He's not going to be able to claim it because there was no witnesses that saw him give us the money. So the innkeeper said a correct thing to his wife. He says, should we, because of one fool, lose our business? Because evidently word will spread, and that's not good. You don't want, you know, bad, you know, PR. So he said the same thing is with a disease. He says, so the disease also. Really, the person, Rabbi Akiva, is saying that when the guy went into the church, right, and he was crippled, and then he came out later on, he was completely upright, so it appears like there's something to the idolatry, right? That's his whole question. It seems like there's something here. But Rabbi Akiva says, no. See, diseases, they have a term, and he's quoting the words, let's just see the words here. It's in the Devarim that diseases are called evil and trustworthy. So evil, we understand. When you have a disease, it's an evil thing. It's painful. What does it mean, trustworthy? So Rabbi Akiva says they're trustworthy because a disease visits the body and it has a certain duration. That's what a disease is by definition. It has a term. There's only a certain amount of time that it stays with the body and then it leaves. What happened was when this guy went into the church, right, it's bound to happen that that was precisely when the disease was about to leave. That's when his back pain was about to leave. So it looks like it had something to do with the church. So what is this analogy of the innkeeper and his wife? So the analogy is that if they would just take the money and deviate from the right path, they would ruin themselves. So the diseases are the same way. So really, by right, like we said earlier, if a person has intercourse with his friend's wife, so by rights, there should not be a baby born because it's an improper union. And if a guy steals wheat and he plants it, so by rights, it shouldn't grow. But the world goes on its regular path. So here also. So the diseases, so to speak, would be talking to each other and saying, we have a certain way that we work. God designed us in a certain way. And if we, really by rights, we shouldn't have left the guy when he went to the church. Because by leaving him, when he is in the church, gives him the false impression that the church has some power, that there's some, that idolatry has some power. But they say, we can't do that. We have an oath. We are trustworthy, meaning we have a certain design, and this is God's will. That's what it means that diseases are evil and trustworthy, meaning there's a design to them. God gave everything a certain specific character and nature, how things work. And they can't go against that, as if they were personified and the diseases were talking and saying, we have to keep our word. That's what it means, trustworthy. It means that they have a certain set design, and that's how God wants the world to work. Just like when you steal seed, so any seed will grow in the ground. It doesn't matter whether you bought it properly or if you stole it. It's not going to change. So the world would go, olam kiminhago noheg is the Hebrew, the world would go according to its natural course, but the people that are corrupt will eventually have to pay the price, and they will be punished. Okay, so maybe somebody wants to just recap what the question was of this guy Zunin, this Jew, who saw this. He says to Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, we both know idolatry doesn't work, but look, I saw this event. The guy was crippled when he went into the church, and when he left, he was perfectly fine, standing upright. So somebody wants to just recap what the facts are, and maybe what the idea is.
Well, it would seem that what he's doing is seeing two distinct actions, one going in the church and the other coming out cured. And he's attributing cause and effect where, in fact, no cause and effect has been established.
Right, exactly.
But he sees the events in proximity, therefore he assumes one caused the other.
Exactly. Okay. Now, since you said that so well and you took away my my job over here, we're going to have to jump right to the next Gemara. There's really nothing further to explain because you said it properly. That's exactly it. So now I'm going to ask you why we need the second case in the Talmud. The second case reads as follows. It says, Rabbah said to Rabbi Yehuda, all right, so two Jews. Rabbah said to, and these are great people in the Talmud. So Rabbah said to Rabbi Yehuda, there is a house of idolatry in this town. And when the world needs rain, meaning when these people in this town need rain, the idolatry appears to them in a dream and says, kill a man for me, and I will bring you rain. So these people killed a man, and it rained. So Rabbi Judas is back to Rabbah, where he says, listen, if I would have already died, I would not have been able to tell you this thing that I heard from Rav, a third rabbi. What did Rav say? So he quotes a verse in, this is in Devarim, Devarim, Deuteronomy 4, and he says that a person is not supposed to bow down to the sun, the moon, the stars, so on and so forth, which God, the literal reading is, which God apportioned to all the people. But the word apportion, chalak, also means smooth. So Rav said, why does the verse over here say that God apportioned? I mean, the little reading is that these stars and all the things in the heaven, God apportioned to all people. There's nothing, it's not specifically helping one group. Okay? But he says that it also means that God made it smooth. What does it mean he made it smooth? He says, you learn from this that God made it smooth with words in order to remove these people from the world. And the Talmud concludes and says, anybody who comes to ruin himself with wrong ideas, the door is open to him. And anybody who comes to purify his thought, he is assisted. I mean to say that when it says that God made these, that you shouldn't bow down to the stars, the sun, the moon, which God smoothed out for everybody. What does it mean smoothed out? It means he paved a way for a person to make the mistakes so they can be removed from the world. That sounds like vindictive. God is like setting up a person for downfall. That's literally what the words mean, that God paved the way. He made these things smooth in order for people to make mistakes and to be removed from the world. And it's interesting, God said the same thing according to Rashi by the spies that went into the land. God said that he's going to give these Jews an ability through the words of the spies in order that they should not inherit Israel. That's pretty wild that he's giving the opportunity. That sounds like an evil thing. How do we understand this? And more primarily, what is this second case here? We had the first case. The guy went to the church crippled. He came out. All right, so it's just merely like you said. The person will take coincidental events, and because of the coincidence, he assumes a relationship. So how is that any different than this case here? The people needed rain. They prayed to their gods in the churches and their idols, wherever it is, you know, these backwards people. They have a dream, and this God comes to them in a dream and tells them, kill a man, and I'll make it rain. So they kill a man, and sure enough, the rain comes. And Rabbi Yehuda's response is a funny type of response. He says, had I already died, I would not have been able to tell you this. Well, I mean, of course, if you're dead, you can't tell me something. What is he saying that for? I mean, when do we ever see that in a conversation in the Talmud, that the rabbi or whoever responds, but as he's responding, he says, if I was already dead, I could not respond to you. That's a little, doesn't strike you as strange? But then he gives his answer. And he gives the answer that the word in the verse that God warns you not to bow down to the solar phenomena or the spheres, the heavenly phenomena, you shouldn't bow down to these things which God had smoothed out. And God smoothed these things out in order to remove a person. This is, right? So There's no shortage of questions over here. And the interesting thing is how the Talmud concludes. This is the third question we'll have to answer. One who comes to impure himself, meaning to go after wrong ideas, the door is open to him. And one who comes to purify his thoughts and live the right life, so then he's assisted. We have to understand that. It's a very potent statement. And why is it here? Okay, are the questions clear? Are the facts clear? Everybody has it?
Yes.
Okay, so let's see if we can take up first, since there's a lot of questions, let's just focus on the two cases. The guy going into the church crippled and then coming out fine. And the second case where they needed rain. The idol appeared to them in a dream, said, kill a man. They did it, and the rain came. And then what Rebbe Yehuda's response was, quoting Rav. But these things God smoothed out. Let's try to understand what the difference is between the two cases, just factually.
Rabbi, I see one part that's similar in that in the first one we discussed that they attributed cause and effect where there wasn't necessarily any. And even in this second case they're doing that because they are presuming that there is cause and effect between slaying the person and the rain coming. But in the second case, they are claiming they got an actual message from God.
Not from God, from an idol.
Right, from their idol. Whereas the first case, you just basically had the two events. So maybe he is bringing up the second case to point out that it doesn't matter if you even feel like you've got some divine message. You're violating a precept of the Torah by committing murder.
Well, they're not bringing it. That's not even discussed. There's no violation discussed here. The issue is, how do we explain an apparent cause and effect relationship? Well, we heard this already in the previous case. I mean, what's new in this case that they had to bring down a second case?
Well, okay, is one basically, I mean, one has to do with something that happens to an individual, another has to do with a change in, what appears to be a change in the laws of nature, where something happens to an entire area. The rain comes.
Well, what's the difference if it's an entire area or if it's somebody's back? Well, that seems to be, you know, inconsequential. I mean, if we really want to just get down to the core differences here, there seems to be there identical cases. There is, however, an element, there has to be a new element in the second case. The Talmud's not going to repeat itself. The first case is dealing with coincidence, right?
Right.
What's the second case dealing with? Think of it that way.
Is it you're appeasing the gods or giving a giving something to the gods and they give you something in return?
Well, it sounds like coincidence. It still sounds like you're assuming a cause and effect relationship which doesn't exist. In both cases, it seems to be this cause and effect which doesn't exist. Either I go into the church and I say the church now heals my back, right? Or I, you know, follow a dream that I had because of this action I do. It has some sort of an effect. It works.
But in the first one, I don't believe the guy was in there seeking that. Specifically, it just happened. The second one, they were going for a specific outcome.
All right, you're getting on the track, right? They're getting on a specific outcome. meaning that God told them in the dream, meaning again, the dream they had was something which culturally they believed. That's why they were, a lot of them were able to have the same dream. Because if you have a culture and you believe certain things, so then people will be, it'll be their sense of reality and they'll have a dream. Because it happened before where they did it, so now they'll dream again that their God is telling them, kill a man again. That's why you can have a common dream across many people. But there's one more thing in this case with the dream that you did not have in the first case with the guy with the broken back.
Is it the idea of a specific request as opposed to we just happen to walk in and come out?
Yeah, that's part of it. But it's more than just a specific request. That's essential to the answer. If you do this, then this will happen. That seems to be what's going on over here in the second case. Meaning, in terms of, we have to boil down what the rabbis and the Gemara are trying to teach us here. The bottom line is they're trying to teach us that idolatry doesn't work, but now when you see cases like this, now how do you explain it? So the first case they're teaching us, the lesson of the first case is that when you see certain coincidences that are unrelated, do not attribute any relationship. That's one way that a person fools themselves, right? If I sneeze and then we have a solar eclipse, so you know, in the old world, or the backward people, they're going to start attributing a relationship because it happened simultaneous, right? When there was coincidence, it's an assumed thing that coincidence means that there's a relationship, because in our everyday lives, that is how it works. I drop a pen out of my hand and it hits the floor, right? Or if I throw a rock at a window, it breaks. So I'm so conditioned to cause and effect. Now when I see something which is happening at the same time, when the rock hit the window, it broke. When the pen hit the floor, it made a sound. So now when a guy goes into the church and he gets healed, I'm now going to attribute it to cause to that there's a relationship. But you would not say that if a guy sneezed and then there was an earthquake in San Diego. You're not going to say there's any, but these people would. This was, in terms of the idolatry, they're going to do this because there is a projected belief. But here it's talking about if there's no relationship, so don't assume that coincidence causes a relationship. That's what you're conditioned to only when there's natural law at work. That's the first lesson. The second lesson, I believe, is a different thing. It's called forecast. If you say, and it doesn't have to happen at the same moment either, if you say that you do X today and Y will happen tomorrow, and it certainly does, so now here's another way a person will assume cause and effect. If you bring a prediction, a forecast, into the equation, now you don't need the simultaneity anymore. There's another way a person can fool themselves into saying that there is cause and effect. Not that it's linked in time, but that it's forecasted this way. Hey, you're right. Look, the guy sneezed today, and you said there was going to be a solar eclipse tomorrow, and sure enough there is. There must be a cause and effect relationship. So that's a foolish thing. You're going outside the world of natural law only because you're fooled by the forecast. All right? So that's what the second portion of the Talmud is showing you. Is another error. There's two areas in which a person makes a mistake and attributes cause and effect relationship when there is none. Either when something is simultaneous, when there's coincidence, or where there's a forecast. It's very interesting. The rabbi honed right in and showed you. That's why there's two cases. All right, is that clear?
Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry, would you mind just explaining the second one again? So what's the second one adding to the first point?
The second one is showing you a different way that people will assume a cause and effect relationship when it does not exist. They're told to kill a person and then it's going to rain. So they kill a person, And now, when it rains, they assume because of that forecast, because of that prediction that was told to them in their dreams, they are now believing there's actual a causal relationship between killing a person and the condensation of moisture in the atmosphere. But that's only because they were forecasted. Let's say didn't have the forecast. Let's say they didn't have a dream, and somebody died on Tuesday. Then it starts raining Tuesday evening. Will you say that now because the person died, that's why it's raining? No. But if you were told, if somebody dies Tuesday afternoon, it's going to rain, and then sure enough that happens, now you're going to start having the question in your head, right? Because somebody introduced a relationship to it, which there isn't, it wasn't there. There was no timing because it happened 8 hours apart. So you're not going to attribute a cause and effect relationship because there's no simultaneity. But there's another mistake that a person makes if he accepts a prediction as tying two things together. So there's two ways a person could make an error and assume a relationship when it is not there. When he sees something two events coinciding, he assumes there's a relationship. I sneeze and then the car, goes off the road into a tree. The same moment, the same exact moment. It seems a little odd. It strikes a person as at the same exact moment I sneezed, the car went in. Wow. I sneeze and then there's a lightning bolt or thunder. That would be amusing, truthfully, if that would happen. If I saw a friend of mine and he sneezed, and as soon as he sneezed, it just, a whole bunch of thunder came around, it would be kind of amusing because intuitively we assume relationships that are when there's coincidence, right? You can see that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but if I tell a guy, listen, you sneeze now and it'll rain at 6 o'clock tonight, he's going to laugh at me, It's 2:30 in the afternoon, he's outside reading a paper on his deck, and I walk over and I say, listen, sneeze right now, make yourself sneeze, whatever. Make a make-believe sneeze, and it's going to rain tonight at 6. So he sneezes. He plays along with me. Sure enough, at 6 o'clock tonight, it starts raining. I'm sure going to get a phone call from him. That's definitely going to happen. But if I didn't say that to him, and if he did sneeze at 2:30 and then it rained at 6, he's not going to put two and two together. But the rabbis understood that this is how the human psyche works. We're constantly comparing. See, the mind is always comparing things. What do I mean? Say, even a baby. How does a baby know that somebody who picked him up is not his mother? And he starts crying because he hasn't developed enough yet to accept trust in somebody new. The reason why he knows not the mother, because the mind, from the time you're born till the time you die, is constantly comparing. So the baby looks, sees a face, compares it to his memory. It's an unconscious thing. It's just automatic. And it has a sense of unfamiliarity. So it's terrified. It starts crying. It sees the mother. It calms down. Because you're constantly comparing when you see something, when you hear something. How do you know when your friend comes to visit you as your friend? As soon as they walk into your house, you see your friend's face because your mind is comparing that to what you know, what you've learned in your life already. It goes through all the faces you've recognized in a split second, and that's how you recognize somebody, because it matches something in your memory. So memory and the act of comparison is what allows you to do the act of recognition. So you're constantly comparing. So the same thing, whenever you see a color, how do I know this is red? Well, it matches something. Let's say I only saw two colors my whole life, red and blue. Somehow that was the only thing I ever saw. Then all of a sudden I see green one day. Well, that has the feeling of being new and novel, because it doesn't match anything I've seen before. So now the feeling of novelty is evoked. That's new. A person goes to a new city they've never been to before, they will naturally feel refreshed. There's something to explore here. I've never been here before. There's an ease in the fact that the mind is now attracted to new views and new layout, new topography, and this is something which is has an effect on a person. See, here also, when a person sees his friend sneeze and then a lightning bolt comes out of the sky, he compared the two things, and they happened coincidentally. So that's going to evoke that type of a cause and effect relationship. Okay? But that can happen also if it's predicted and it's not at the same moment. It could be hours later, days later, weeks later. But if the forecast entered the picture, now you're going to start thinking, hey, was that person right? Is there a relationship here? So the rabbis are trying to tell you, be on your guard. Don't try to attribute any type of cause and effect relationship unless natural law demands it. Just because it happens simultaneously, or it happens because it's forecasted, these are no causes. These are not causes. It's a human error. All right? Okay. Any questions?
Could you go over how the situation with the husband and wife, how it relates to both of these situations? Because the situation with the priest, they seem very related, but the situation with the innkeepers doesn't seem very related.
Okay, so that was going on the case of Zunin, who asked Rabbi Akiva. He said, we both know that idolatry doesn't work, but I saw this crippled guy go in to the church, and he came out healed. So Rabbi Akiva explains to him that it's a mushel, that really what he's trying to tell them, the bottom line is that the disease was going to leave him at this point. It just happened to be he went into the church at that moment. So now you're just assuming that the coincidence of him going to the church and the disease leaving him, you're assuming a relationship. But he wants to give him an analogy. And he says that really he's trying to give the analogy and show how disease has a certain duration and it has to leave at a certain time. And God's not going to change the way nature works in order to not mislead this one person. Right, God's not going to change the way nature works. Disease had to leave. In this guy's case, the disease had to leave exactly when he walked into the church. But God's not going to make all the changes that would be necessary in the laws of nature. You know what it would take in order that this guy's disease didn't leave at that moment? The entire human biology would have to have been uprooted because it's happening because of the way the human body works. So to make the change in this person is going to destroy the world, basically. So God doesn't do that. So the same thing with the innkeeper. The innkeeper says to his wife, because one guy comes and doesn't follow the right protocol, and he just trusts us, and he doesn't leave his money with us with any witnesses, so we should now ruin our business. The business is the disease. It's the parable to the disease. Meaning, we should ruin our business. Everybody trusts us, and we work. We have a good system here, and we should ruin that and risk it by taking this guy's money and denying that he ever gave it to us because there's no witnesses. So he's trying to give it. Okay, you see it?
Well,
yes?
No, but I had a different idea.
Yeah.
You were thinking that maybe it demonstrates the extent to which people will go to believe something or to see something a certain way despite their proper reasoning and despite the evidence that states otherwise. So meaning, the innkeeper is telling his wife, like, don't you realize that even if we have a long-standing reputation, that our inn is a trustworthy place, or we're trustworthy and our inn is an honest institution and a good place to stay, one bad move or one glitch in the reputation will really destroy it entirely. Just like a person would be willing to say, based on a simple coincidence of a person going into some kind of church or something, and then this guy getting healed, they'd be willing to abandon all of their reasoning about disease and about illnesses in general to say that there's some kind of relationship between this guy getting healed and what he did that day.
But that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that the analogy is between the innkeeper deviating and the diseases deviating.
Okay.
So we have to follow what the Gemara says. Alright? Where it says, the Talmud says that, he says, so also, the afflictions, meaning the diseases that at a certain time they come to a person, and they are sworn to stay until a certain day, a certain hour, and they don't leave except at that time, and a certain moment. And through a certain medication, and through a certain event, whatever, means a very specific plan of how the diseases finally leave the body. And since that moment comes, the Talmud says, they leave. And that's when this guy went to the house of idolatry. So they swear to keep their proper behavior, just like the innkeeper swears to keep his proper behavior. Just like the innkeeper would destroy his livelihood by deviating even once. So if that's how the diseases work, they would deviate and they would destroy how the body has to work and how diseases have to work. Okay. Now, we had two more questions. One was, what does it mean when Rabbi Yehuda says back to Rava, he says, had I been dead, I could not tell you an answer to your question. What does it mean, had I been dead? Right? We asked that question before. What type of intro? Just tell him the answer. But I think what he's trying to say over here, and I never saw this before, I looked at this Gemara many times. I think what he's saying is that, see, Rava asked the question about when the place that needed rain, the second case, and the false god came to the people in the dream and says, kill a man and you'll have rain. So I think what Rub is trying to do is trying to neutralize that very case. In that case, killing a person was a good. Right? That's how it worked out. They killed the person and the rain came. So Rava, I think in like a sarcastic type of a tone, he says, you think killing a person is good? Had I been dead, you wouldn't get an answer to your question. So killing a person would be bad in this case. So I think it was like a little bit of a jest that he was doing. That's why he said, had I been dead. Of course, if he was dead, he would never be able to answer him. But he's responding to the very case where Rava is saying, look, you know, they killed the guy and it started raining. What's going on? So Rava was like saying, it seems to be there that, you know, the death is something which brought, you know, good into the world. So Rava says back, no, because if my death is something which already took place, you wouldn't get an answer to your question. So he's neutralizing the case, I think. It's just a very subtle thing he's saying. You see that? He's just like giving a little bit of an anecdote to just one aspect of it. But then he gives his answer. And he says that, what does it mean that in the verse, that God smoothed out? It doesn't mean that God just apportioned all these heavenly phenomena, the sun, the moon, the stars. That he apportioned it for the whole world. He didn't really give it as any to have any powers over anything. So it also means that he smoothed it out. He made it easy for people to assume idolatry. What does that mean? So I gave the example of where when the Jews were going to sin with the spies. So God says, or Rashi actually quotes this, and he says, God says, I'm going to give them a chance with the spies in order that they should not inherit the land. So that doesn't mean God's vindictive. What it means to say is that God's going to give them the opportunity that their flaw can be expressed in reality. That's a good. That is a good thing. Because now the person could face his problem. So God says, by their lives, I'm going to give them a chance to make an error with the words of the spies in order that they don't get the land. Doesn't mean that he didn't want to give them the land. Of course he wanted to give the Jews the land. But he wanted to give them the opportunity to see their mistake openly, which ends up they wouldn't get the land. But it's more important that they see the mistake and then they can correct themselves. Then they should just get the land of Israel. The land of Israel is not the be-all and end-all. So when God says these words and they sound vindictive, you have to stop and analyze them. What is going on here? This has to be another possibility. Because God only wants the good for a person. So when he says that I'm going to give them a chance here also by idolatry, I'm going to smooth out the way to idolatry, that means God is going to allow a person to have the ability to choose either good or to choose the bad interpretation. That's where the Gemara ends, that if a person comes to be corrupt, the door is open to him. Meaning God does not zap him with a lightning bolt every single time he does something wrong, because then where's your free will? Now you're not using your mind to dissuade yourself from the wrong life, but you're just afraid. You're going to get zapped by a tremendously powerful lightning bolt. That's why I'm not going to do the evil. God doesn't want that. God wants it to be that you have an equal playing field. but it's interesting. It says that the person who comes to do the wrong in life, the door is open to him. But a person who comes to do the good, it doesn't say the door is open. It says he is assisted. That means that that's where God leans. There you get assistance. You don't get assistance in terms of leading the wrong life, but you have the free will, you can go anywhere you want. But if you try to live the good life, God is going to give you a little bit of more of a nudge, so to speak, that will help you, because that's what he really wants. So God leans towards helping a person towards the right life. He doesn't just make it completely equal playing field which way you want to go. Of course you have free will. But what does it mean if we can go a step further now? How is it that God will help a person if he wants to live the right life? So you could say that there's two things. First of all, knowledge is of something is much more powerful than belief. So if you have knowledge of something, so that's something which the body, psychologically, the, not the body, the person's mind is going to latch on to more. It has more conviction. When you see something proven, that is more conviction than just something you believe, that you accept through the emotions. So that's one way that God tilts the scales towards living the right life. But could be another way is that in terms of what you see in the world, that there's a certain system, that is the way it works, is that it's it leans towards reality. Meaning it is. Going when you go against reality, it's more friction. But if you go with what you see and what you understand, that there's more momentum in that way, because that's what, I mean, it's sort of similar to the first answer. But one is an internal conviction. The first answer is when you live a life of intelligence, that type of convictions that you have are stronger. But also the external world that you see works along the lines of reason and proof, and that is something which will lean a person more towards that if he's not emotionally bent. But you see that the outcome is that God wants the person to have the ability to choose either way. Although reality does teach him, if he wants to follow his intelligence, you can see through coincidences. You can see through things that are forecasted. And you can uncover the problems and see why there's no reason to attribute any relationship. But the emotions do want to automatically, you know, compare and say, oh, two things happened at the same time, there must be a relationship. Oh, something was forecasted, that means there must be a real relationship. But if you follow intelligence, you'll see that it's not so. That the relationships are really projected, but they really are not there. In reality, it's just something which you make up. And we understand why you make it up, because the human mind is constantly comparing things. So there's a danger over there. Okay. Questions, comments? Go ahead.
None here.
All right, Rachel, Svetlana, is everything clear?
Yeah, we're good.
You good?
So, Rabbi, just to make sure I'm clear, so in the end, he's basically saying, if you want to go down the wrong path, it'll be available to you. If you want to go down the right path, I'll give you support.
Right.
Okay.
But it could be that it's not like, you know, he's stepping in, which it could be he does also. That God does. I mean, we just don't know when God is doing something unless we see a miracle or unless a prophet tells us. But outside of that, we can't say how he's doing it, but I'm just suggesting that even the design, psychologically, we are more convinced when we see proof that it's something which we can be, it's like a rock, it's like immovable. Yes, when you're convinced and you see something 100% proof, that outweighs any belief. That's one way that you're assisted more towards the life of reason. But also the way, just the external world, how it functions. It assists a person to direct him. Everything is
perfect.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say then that from a religious perspective, the only reality out there is either Judaism or, you know, being a no Amalekite. And if that's the case, that is definitely the minority. And why is that the case if God assists in one aspect and only leaves the door open on the other? Why do so many people go the other way?
Because of the first part of that statement. It says, one who comes to live the right life, God assists. The rest of the world, the majority of the world, is not coming to live the right life. They're very tranquil living with the false idea. So, that's it. But if they would come to examine, meaning if a person has to first initiate a life of reason, then he'll be open to it. But if the mind is not looking for rationality, God's not going to just put it into your memory banks, or that's not how it works. It has to be that you start the process. That's what it means. One who comes to corrupt himself, so then the door is open to him. But if a person comes to purify himself, that means he has to make the steps. He must initiate the process. These people aren't doing that. They're not looking for reason. They're happy just reciting whatever their pastors tell them. This is it. They're inculcated. Not one of these Palestinian kids is questioning the fact that the Jews are evil. They're told this from youth. That's it. The mind is not functioning.
That answers that question. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, so we got a lot of nice, very, very nice to see how the rabbis addressed this and the insight that they had. You know, just that idea itself is the difference between coincidence and forecasting. That's a very nice idea, and it's it shows how they really had a real insight. I mean, you see the two cases. You just read the Talmud. You know what's going on. There's a lot of cases. It sounds similar, but it's like King Solomon said: if you dig for it like silver and you search it out like buried treasure. So then you understand the knowledge of God. And Das Elokim Timsi, you'll find that knowledge of God. But this is why. Ki Hashem Yitein Chachma Mipiv Das Usmuna. Why is it that you have to dig for it so hard? And if you do, then you'll find the treasure. I mean, then you'll find knowledge. Because Mipiv Tetzei Chachma, because from his mouth comes forth wisdom. One second, how's it going? Let me get the part. I just lost it.
One sec.
This is Mishlei. I think it's 2, right in the beginning. Here we go. Because Guy, he says like this, because why is it that you have to dig for it like silver and buried treasure? This is Proverbs 2, right in the beginning, the first few verses of chapter 2. He says, the reason we have to dig for it like silver and like a buried treasure is because God gives forth wisdom, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Two things. Because God gives forth wisdom, meaning the source is God. Since the source of all wisdom is God, therefore it's a tremendously deep and source that all wisdom comes from. And then he says the second reason, mipiv das usmuna, from his lips, meaning, what does it mean, God's lips? He doesn't have lips. Lips means what articulates words. So the written word in the Torah is so formulated that there's a tremendous amount of knowledge you can get from it. So for two reasons, you have to dig for wisdom if you really want to get it. All right, we could just look at the Talmud, and very nice, it's two stories, but if you understand that this knowledge is something from the rabbi, so it's reflecting God's knowledge, so that should be you have to realize that there is something tremendous here, so you have to dig for it. And the wealth of knowledge that's available, it's just like an unlimited, it's like a bottomless pit. but also realize that the articulation, meaning the piv from his mouth, meaning how God articulated his Torah, that's a tremendous study in itself. So we look at the words and we see how the rabbis are taking the words and even the way they speak. He says in the beginning of, I think the beginning of Psalms, that the wise people, the righteous, so they're equated to a tree. And it says that their fruit is give forth in good time and their leaves do not wither. So if the wise people are equated to a tree, so what then is fruit and what are leaves? Right, this is right in the beginning of Psalms. Just turn there. Okay. It says, yeah, this is Psalms 1:3. He shall be like a tree deeply rooted along brooks of water that yields its fruit in season and whose leaf never withers. So why is a righteous person, if he's like a tree, what is his fruit and what is his leaves? What are his leaves?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Seems like leaves represent the ability to take...
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Seems like the leaves represent the ability to take in nourishment, so perhaps that's the... person's ability to take in ideas and process them appropriately, and then the fruits are the results or the produce, which would be the good deeds of the person.
Well, how are leaves what you take in? I thought the roots are how they take the nourishment in.
The sun. Photosynthesis is done through the leaves.
And that does what, as opposed to the roots? See, I thought that the, like you're saying, that the fruit is the primary. I would say like this: the fruit is the primary product of the tree, right?
Right.
You eat the fruit. You don't eat the leaves.
To make fruit, you have to have energy. The leaves convert the sun's rays through photosynthesis into storable energy, producing the complex hydrocarbons.
Uh-huh.
And from that energy, the tree now has the ability to produce fruit.
Mm. I hear that. I would say that they may not be going to that level of scientific, analogy, but that simply that the tree has two products. You wouldn't say that the roots or the trunk or the branches are products of the tree. But what regenerates every year are two things, fruit and leaves, right? So just from that standpoint, I would say that the righteous are equated to the tree. They are on springs, they're planted by springs, which means that they have the right nutrients. They have the right source of life, which is water, which is Torah. And because of that, they produce two things. They produce, when they speak Torah, that's their primary fruit. That's what fruit is. But there's also the everyday speech. Everyday speech, that's the leaves. I mean, the two products of a righteous person are his when he speaks in Torah, and then when he speaks in business or he speaks to his friend. Even there, those don't wither. Meaning in both areas, there's a tremendous amount. That's what I'm saying with the rabbis that we learn in the Talmud. Even when he jested and he said, hey, if I would have been dead right now, I couldn't give you the answer. Even that... there was something to derive from. That was like the leaf that he was producing. But when he recited over Rava's statement, so then that was the fruit. The real fruit was the real Divrei Torah, the real words of Torah. But even the way he delivered it was like the leaf's not withering. I mean, there's two products of a person living properly. Because there's only two areas that you can produce. You can produce in Torah or everything else. So, but the bottom line is that King Solomon said in the beginning of Proverbs that if we recognize that two things, that knowledge comes from God and that the articulated words also in the way he encases, there's a whole study to unraveling the words of the Torah. If we have that appreciation, then we're going to be, we'll finally get wisdom because then we know where to look, we know what we're looking for. and then God will assist us. But if we're not on that path and we're not looking to, if our mind's eye is not open, so there's nothing we're going to see. It's like a person who's on a train going through the most beautiful hillside, but he's sleeping. So there's no way he can partake the view. He cannot partake of the view. But if he opens his eyes, he has to initiate the process. Then he can start seeing some of the beauty, and then he turns his head, and then, wow, will he see, you know, some beautiful scenery. So that's why the nations of the world, they are not looking for it. So that's why they're not finding it. If you're not digging for a buried treasure, you are not going to get it. Impossible. Okay, any other questions?
Rabbi, when I think of the process of sort of digging for the buried treasure, too, I look at it that the emotions have a head start, and that if you just kind of go along with your emotions, unless you bump up against the laws of nature or whatever, it doesn't really cause you to think about things, so you really have to dig to change the process of living through your mind instead of your emotions.
Yeah. You do have to change. As I start, you're right. This is true. It's not easy, but if you have the right teachers...
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
So, you know, if you have the right... you're right. I mean, you're just trying to say that it's not an easy thing to get onto that path?
Right.
Yeah. Right, but that itself is a study. Why did God create man in a way where the emotions have like a head start of about 13 years. Evidently, there's a need for that as well. All right, we'll have to discuss that in another, I guess, another session. All right, so for next week, we are on, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, so to review it over, it's quite a mouthful that we did. Very interesting, though. It's a really nice piece of the Talmud there. All right, I guess we'll pick up next week. I'll see where we'll go. I'm not really sure what we'll take up next week yet, but we'll see. Maybe if I have an answer like during the week, I'll definitely give you a heads up. All right?
Sounds good. Thank you, Rabbi. Very interesting.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
All right, so have a great day, everybody. A good week, and we'll be in touch during the week.
Okay.
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 Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Okay, that ends today's session. We'll put this online, so you can listen to it in its entirety if you came late, if you missed any portion of it. And we will continue next week, 11:15 New York time. And until then, we'll have a very good week.